Marty, me and Travis, we watched your movie. We enjoyed it a great deal.
We've already been talking about it, but we want your input.
We've already kind of laid the groundwork, Marty.
Okay.
Travis has a barrage of questions for you, though, I'm sure.
Oh, sure, yeah. Swing away. I couldn't remember if you guys if we sent you an online screener, so I'm glad you saw it.
Oh, we did. We did. And actually, you telling us in the movie that there's bootlegs available actually gave me the opportunity to go back and watch the movie too, which I
so you saw the Corman original recently then?
It's on YouTube. You can watch it anytime you want. Yeah, and I didn't know. I knew about the 1994 Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie, but I had never seen it. I didn't even know I could see it, and so I was excited to see your documentary, and then I was excited to watch the movie also. So
I have yet to see the motion picture itself, but the documentary made me very happy. Only because I remember 12-year-old Travis in 1992 getting Heroes Illustrated and seeing pictures from the set of that movie of The Thing and also of Doctor Doom, and being super excited that I was going to see a Fantastic Four movie. I mean, you're talking, what, 2 years after the Batman, like the big Michael Keaton Batman movie? And seeing Doctor Doom and The Thing on screen made me very happy, just in production stills. And then it disappeared. There was nothing after that. So seeing this documentary of what actually happened to this movie made me very, very happy. I'm almost leery to watch the actual motion picture itself.
Yeah, you see, I'm not going to say it's a problem, but I am going to say that. Don't set your sights too high, man. I mean, the movie was made for less than $1 million, and it's an effects-heavy attempt, you know?
But I think if you go in there with that expectation, you'll be pleasantly surprised that, actually, I'd say of the four Fantastic Four movies, it's probably the best one.
Yeah, you know, the general consensus is that they got, you know, the most right, you know? Dr. Doom has been a tough character in the Fox movies to the point where he's almost it's not the character, it's a name only. But Joseph Culp and Ole Sassone, the director of Corman's movie, they nailed him, you know? It was right out of the pages of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby's issues.
If I could say anything, I'd say it was dated. It's kind of like if today you went back and said you don't like Limp Bizkit. Like, everybody at one time liked Limp Bizkit. It's real cool guy to go back and say you didn't like him now.
I still like Limp Bizkit.
But if you watch it, it looks like it was made in 1994. And
it does, yeah. It is a product of the 90s, absolutely.
Well, is there ever... when is the last time a motion picture that was based off of a comic book property has been made for less than $1 million? That's an insane amount of money to try to take a comic book property and make an actual, like, hour and a half to 2 hour movie.
Yeah, it's funny. You know what? That's a question that I actually have an answer to that nobody's ever asked before. And it was a number of years ago, Man-Thing was made into
I love that movie.
Direct-to-video.
Yes, Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah, Sikorsky directed it. Exactly,
yeah, yeah.
Right. And that was probably about $1 million. So, and that was a trip.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good for what it was. Like, for Man-Thing, and when I that was another one that I heard that, hey, we're making a Man-Thing movie. And then you didn't hear anything for a couple of years, and it's like, oh no, you can get it on DVD now because everybody kind of just wrote it off. And it was kind of the same thing with the Fantastic Four.
So the movie, it's alluded to, but you don't really have like a silver bullet, but what's it's that? Alluded to that the movie was never intended to come out. It was made
right.
To kind of keep the rights and the cast and crew was not aware of that. But,
I wish they would have done the same thing with Spider-Man 3, where they said, we need to make another movie, but we don't have to release it, we just have to make it.
You mean the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man?
No, Spider-Man 3, the one with Venom and Sandman and whatever the fuck James Franco was supposed to be.
Yeah, Sam Raimi's made a lot of apologies for that one.
They had emo Spider-Man. He had all the feelings and emotions.
That scene where he dances down the street and he's like pointing at the ladies who are looking at him with disgust is one of the worst things I've ever seen committed to film.
Yeah, that's a ready-made meme, man. That was bad.
So you interviewed Roger Corman for the movie, but it didn't seem like he had like a whole lot of insight. Was he like talking to a wall, or?
It was difficult. You know, we only had him for 20 minutes. We were only told we were going to interview him about 3 days before the interview. I mean, we were prepared, but he was prepared. I asked kind of the initial question. He spoke for maybe 10 or 12 minutes with this really kind of preset ramble. And I was so disappointed at one point because after I'd done our interview, I did a search on Roger Corman, you know, online to see if he'd ever talked about it before. And I found this clip where he says almost the exact same thing he told me.
Oh, so he just read the thing he said last time?
Kind of, you know. And I mean, he held everything very close, you know, to the vest. He was careful not to say anything that, you know, would possibly kind of come back at him.
Do you think that he was paid hush money, Marty?
No, well, I mean, it depends on how you define hush money. I mean, he was certainly, as in the doc you see, I mean, he was paid off. And he's the businessman, you know.
Yeah.
You can't really blame him for taking a deal where his company was able to make a profit of, you know, of $1 million after he had been paid three quarters of them. You know, for the budget to make the movie, God knows how much he actually spent of that. So, you know, I mean, he's Roger Corman. You know, there's a reason why he was one of the most successful movie producers has ever been.
Well, yeah, his entire career has kind of been predicated on the fact that he can make a movie for $3 and a sandwich.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. And he pulled that off. There's such a great piece in the documentary where a number of the actors' crew talk about his the Venice stage, you know, the Corman Studios. And
I think that was my favorite part, actually.
Oh,
when they said it was like a giant warehouse.
Warehouse
with a bunch of, like, wallpaper put up to, like, replicate it, like, science laboratory.
I had the Hollywood music playing in my da-da-da-da Hollywood.
Yeah, and they would just repaint the set, and they'd make Carnosaur, and they'd repaint the set, and they'd make Cage T-3000, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing to me, though, and did you have any kind of a feeling before you actually talked to the actors how excited they were and how much they, like, kind of were banking on this movie to, like, do really big things? I mean, because they all said that, hey, we're doing this giant property for a shoestring budget, and we know it's Roger Corman, but we really think that this can do big things for our careers, and that we can... Did you have any idea before talking to them that they actually felt this way, that they thought, hey, man, this could have been really big for everybody?
Yeah, you know, kind of I did. Mark Sykes, the executive producer of Doomed, was on the set and on location. He was a buddy of mine who I grew up with, and that was kind of my in with this story. You know, he was Roger Corman's receptionist, and he was the casting assistant on the film. And he's the one who had gotten, you know, all the actors lined up for us. And, you know, he let me know their feelings of the movie. And there was a lot of, you know, hurt ones. There was a lot of hurt feelings. These guys really got the raw end there.
Marty, do you think that this movie is kind of more infamous now for having not come out than if it had just come out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all you have to do is look at, you know, like the Dolph Lundgren Punisher or the Matt Salinger Captain America, and it would have just been sitting alongside those.
It would have just faded away, right?
I'm telling you what, Marty, I would like to see documentaries on both of those motion pictures that you just mentioned, because I loved those as a
kid. Right, wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, the state comic book movies at that point was, they just didn't get it, you know? I mean, Batman was a huge film in the late 80s, and they were only just understanding the value of these properties.
Well, and like I mentioned before, like when I saw the stills from the Fantastic Four movie, and that's what sets, like, your documentary apart from, say, the Superman Lives documentary, is, like, that movie, nobody ever even realized that was happening. Your documentary is based on a movie that everybody knew was happening. Like, everybody knew the production stills. Like, hey, this is a Fantastic Four movie. It's being filmed right now. We have all of these stills. It's going to come to you anytime now. And then it just disappeared. But it was an age before the internet where you had no idea what the hell happened to all of this footage. It was like, we're making a Fantastic Four movie. And then it was radio silence. You just had no idea what was happening.
Yeah, we had that, you know, the film threat cover story was kind of like my entree into it outside of my relationship with Mark, because that was enormous. That was, you know, there was 20 pages inside that magazine, and it was just such terrific coverage. Chris Gore was the guy we talked to in the documentary who ran Film Threat. He was there for every day, and he just killed himself putting out this issue. And when it went away, you know, he was just distraught.
Well, and I had no idea that this was, you know, it was Chris Gore, like, who I know from Attack of the Show, but I didn't realize that he was probably the one responsible for me seeing the pictures of Dr. Doom, the pictures of the Thing, the pictures of the family together that I saw in, like, Wizard and Heroes Illustrated. I had no idea that he was the one, the only one, that was bringing us the media coverage from this thing. And how did, do you know how he got involved? Like, did he ask to be on the set, or did they say, hey, come and cover what we're doing?
No, that was all him. I mean, he had heard about it through the trades. Hollywood Reporter had a cover story of it. We show it in the movie, and it's just this bland blue and red cover for the Hollywood Reporter, and it said the Fantastic Four on it, a Constantine's film production or something. Chris Gore saw that, and he just called. He just cold called Corman's studio and said, hey, can I come along? The only other kind of presence at that time, because you're right, it was pre-internet, Rob Allstetler was a guy who ran Comic Buyer's Guide. Do you guys remember that? That newspaper?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they had some coverage on it too, but I mean, Chris was, you know, he brought a camera, and I mean, he just shot the hell about it. We were in his place, and he just had, you know, all the images you see were all generated by him on the set, and he just has stills and just pages and pages of this stuff. He's the one that got us the storyboards we use that we have filmed. He got me like 4 different drafts of the script that were written.
I see that he right now is trying to, like, kickstart a resurgence for Film Threat with a bunch of signed copies of that particular issue, which is amazing. And it's got to be, for him anyway, like, as a fanboy, which I would consider myself, like, to be able to be a part of that and to be able to get access to that film had to have been amazing for him. And then I know in the documentary he said a handful of days in, he realized that, oh no, this might not be exactly what we were looking for.
It's great, yeah. When he sees the costumes, and you literally see the stitching, you know, on the costumes. You literally see the costume designer who had no money, you know, sitting at a sewing machine making these things, and it became clear to him, you know, and there was that kind of sinking feeling that I think he felt, that this might not be the most, you know, realized film possible.
Well, I mean, what the explanation that you gave in the documentary, and I guess this is a bit of a spoiler, but
I thought it was an amazing explanation.
He said, well, she made him.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And I love it.
How did Tobey Maguire make that awesome Spider-Man costume all by himself, Marty? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Rebecca tells a story where Ole, the director, tells her, she's like, you know, own it. You know, you made these. And she tells the story with such kind of warmth. And that was the thing. Everybody had such an amazing time making the movie. You know, they became friends. They became tight. I mean, it was only a 3-week shooting schedule. But they became, you know, that little family and took responsibility for the characters and for how they were portrayed.
Well, Marty, I appreciate you coming on. I'm sorry we had the technical difficulties or whatever was going on. But
oh, that was on me. I apologize. I was driving, so that was obviously me.
No,
hey,
no big
don't
deal.
Talk. Don't talk while you're driving. If I could say one thing in this episode of the podcast, is like, make sure, kids, no texting and driving, no talking and driving. But always pull over to the side of the road.
But guys, I mean, don't follow Marty's, you know, poor example on driving while talking on the phone, but do see his movie, Doomed, The Untold Story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four.
And I will 100% endorse this motion picture, and if you listen to the show, you know how much of a fan I am of every comic book property and all of the things. I loved Batman and Superman, so...
Travis, you make sure you put a reminder in your phone to make sure to let listeners know when the date drops to remind them to go out and get it on video.
It's an amazing documentary, and if you are about my same age, about 35, and you realized, you know, at 12 years old that the Fantastic Four movie was happening and it disappeared from you right before your eyes, watch this documentary, because it is amazing. It is amazing to see what happens in the Hollywood spotlight and with franchise rights, and it'll make you dislike the behind the scenes thing a little bit, I think.
Yeah. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, Marty. Take it easy.
Thanks, Marty.
Take care. Bye-bye.